The headlines: Kremlin denies using Iranian drones in the war in Ukraine. The Palestinian Authority embraces Australia's decision to reverse its recognition of West Al-Quds as Israel's capital. And the UK Prime Minister Liz Truss makes it clear that she will hang on to power despite apologizing for her mistakes. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia has denied using Iranian drones in its strikes against Ukraine amid allegations to that effect by Western officials. The Kremlin spokesman says Russia is using domestically made drones with Russian names in the attack. Dmitry Peskov says he has no information showing purchase of Iranian drones. Ukraine and its Western allies claim Russia has used Iranian-made suicide drones in its recent spate of attacks, especially in Kyiv. The Ukrainian government has downgraded its diplomatic relations with Iran over this allegation. Iran has roundly rejected the claim. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has said Tehran supplied no drones to Moscow for use in the war against Ukraine, adding that arms deliveries to the warring parties will only prolong the crisis. Ukraine's capital is hit with new strikes a day after the city came under deadly drone attacks by the Russian military. Ukrainian officials say three attacks have struck the power facility in northern Kyiv. They are reporting explosions at the site. The presidential office says the target was critical infrastructure. Kyiv was also hit by Russian attacks on Monday. They killed four people and damaged energy facilities and residential buildings. The Russian military has also launched strikes on energy infrastructure in the eastern Ukrainian region of Sumy, killing several people. Attacks on the capital come days after Russia's president blamed Ukraine for an explosion on the key Crimea bridge and vowed retaliation for the attack. Strong condemnation coming out of Iran following EU sanctions over its response to the riots in the country. The foreign ministry is now promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities. The ministry spokesman says EU sanctions constitute a violation of international law and are a clear example of meddling in Iran's internal affairs. Nasser Kanani says the EU's decision shows its bias and that it is using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. He added that the EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation in Iran as a major violator of human rights due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh U.S. sanctions on the country. Earlier, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It's an unconstructive act out of miscalculation, based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
Amir Abdullahian's tweet came hours after EU foreign ministers imposed sanctions on Iran. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and four entities. The bans target a section of Iran's police charged with ensuring moral security, as well as the Basij Volunteer Force and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology is also blacklisted. Some European officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest that followed the death of a young woman last month. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died in a hospital days after collapsing at a police station in Iran. A forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. Head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission Masoud Shajari says there is a clear difference between rioting and protesting, and no government is in the world will allow riots during protests.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, is part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's life. I mean, we have seen footage of security forces in Iran being kept and then put a light, petrol put on them and put a light. No government, no authority could allow this sort of behavior to be unleashed in their society, because they have the responsibility and indeed the duty to protect people and create security within the society. You know, I could give you over and over history of what is being done in Britain. I mean, for example, the riots in Bradford, the judge orders and said anyone who holds the stone, even if they don't throw it and they drop it on CCTV, should get 5 years imprisonment. Anyone holding a Molotov cocktail, and even if not throwing it and dropping it, should get 8 years imprisonment.
The Palestinian Authority hails Australia's decision after Canberra said it is reversing the previous administration's decision to recognize West Al-Quds as the Israeli capital. The Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has described the turnaround as a correction of a mistake previously made by Canberra. Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong announced the reversal of the 2018 decision a few hours ago. Wong said only talks between Israelis and Palestinians should determine the status of Al-Quds. Canberra's announcement has angered Israel. The regime's prime minister has strongly criticized the move. The regime has also summoned the Australian ambassador to lodge a protest. Former Australian government took a step on Al-Quds after similar moves by the U.S. and a few other Western countries. For more on that, we're joined by Muti Abu Musabi, a Palestinian political activist. If you could please tell us the significance of this move by Australia. How important do you see this move? Can it lead to more serious moves by Australia, including recognizing the state of Palestine?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. Actually, this decision is highly welcomed and appreciated by the Palestinian people, and we consider it as a bold move in the right direction, especially amid the ongoing unabated Israeli attempts to change the realities on the ground and to create a new de facto by allowing the groups of settlers to invade Al-Aqsa and storm Al-Aqsa yards on a daily basis. This is an important step taken by the Australian government, and it should encourage and embolden the other governments which followed the former U.S. President Donald Trump by his abhorrent deal of the century that obliged them to transform their embassies into Al-Aqsa, into Al-Quds city. So we think that this decision and this step actually presents a new evidence and a concrete evidence that the Palestinians' right in their capital, Jerusalem, will never be abandoned or will never be dropped by the Israeli attempts armed by the U.S. administration positions and the silence of the international community. So we consider this as a bold move in the right direction.
Thank you very much, Muti Abu Musabi, Palestinian political activist, joining us live from Gaza. Moving on, U.S. officials have not been invited to a Saudi investment conference planned for later this month, and that is according to the organizer of the event. The decision comes amid growing tensions between Washington and Riyadh over a decision by OPEC Plus to cut oil production by 2 million barrels a day from November. The conference dubbed Future Investment Initiative, or FII, is set to begin on October 25th in Riyadh. The three-day event usually draws top Wall Street investors, entrepreneurs, and high-ranking officials from around the world. The organizer says a move not to invite American officials this year is made to avoid the international conference becoming a political platform. Richard Addis said that he does not want the media attention to be diverted to political agendas between Washington and Riyadh. Independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joined us earlier for comment. He explained that the recent tensions between Riyadh and Washington are rooted in a broader dispute over Saudis shifting away from the U.S. dollar.
It was unforeseeable that the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia would change their preferences for alignments and friends as they have over the last several months. The decision to snub Biden's request for cutbacks in production is part of a broader development of policy in Saudi Arabia, and I think in particular of the shift away from the dollar, the de-dollarization of trading in oil that we see in Saudi's relationships with China.
New data exposed the depth of the ongoing cost of living crisis in the UK. A food charity says millions of cash-strapped Britons have made ends meet by skipping meals over the past month. The Food Foundation says hunger levels increased more than twofold since January. It says around 10 million adults and 4 million children did not afford regular meals last month. Some of these people had to go hungry for an entire day. Charities say the government must halt cuts to benefits and take stronger measures to protect the vulnerable. People in the UK have been feeling the squeeze of the soaring prices for months. Britain's inflation is now at a four-decade high. This is driven by inflated food and energy prices due to the crisis in Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. The UK's Prime Minister apologizes to the public for her economic mistakes amid backlash over her so-called mini-budget.
I recognize we have made mistakes. I'm sorry for those mistakes, but I've fixed the mistakes. I've appointed a new Chancellor. We have restored economic stability and fiscal discipline. And what I now want to do is go on and deliver for the public.
Truss is also insisting that she will not be stepping down and would definitely lead her party to the general elections. This comes after her plan to cut tax for the higher earners sent markets into turmoil and caused uproar in the parliament. Truss was forced to fire her finance minister over the proposals that were part of the so-called mini-budget. She is also facing calls to resign from within her own party. Truss's new economy minister, Jeremy Hunt, now says that he will reverse almost all tax measures announced in the mini-budget. The UK is grappling with high inflation and a slow economic growth that have raised fears of a looming recession in the country.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there's the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her in the building behind me at the moment, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Bourizab, London.
France is bracing for fresh disruptions amid a cost-of-living crisis as strikes are spilling over into new sectors. Trade unions have called a nationwide transport strike for higher wages on Tuesday. Other industries and public sector have also announced industrial actions to protest soaring energy prices and hiking inflation. The wave of walkouts follow weeks-long strikes in oil depots and refineries that have triggered a nationwide fuel shortage. The industrial action has also spread to the nuclear giant EDF. Nationwide demonstrations against soaring prices are also planned for today. People are angry at the high cost of living, partially due to the war in Ukraine and the anti-Russia sanctions by European countries. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gettner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations. And it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is, so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian-speaking population, culturally Russian population. And then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways with the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia. But it is understandable
from an analytical perspective, if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options, and it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. that you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things. So what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, you know, in terms of, at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they're being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria, in many ways, trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO, no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and raw materials, is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point, briefly. We don't have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So to Ukraine, I have to say, Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that I would be in. They would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated but they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really, because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would be a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity. Right. Sovereignty.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, like Henry Kissinger and Jamir Sharma as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. Politically, you're correct. So your second point, the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division of Europe back. like in the Cold War, but this was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization. We have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
It's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science. It's ridiculous. To talk to Russian
scientists. We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here. So we have this new coordinator summit there, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is because I'm coming from Vienna. We had the Vienna Congress of 1815. Exactly. We had the Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as well, and created an order for Europe, which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war, but then it lasted another half century after the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say, there were all colonial powers. So their interventions in the South, that was permitted.
Exactly. That was part of the
caveat of this.
Exactly.
Yeah. But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say.
Right.
Then you had this war. So Europeans should think about it. Is this type applicable to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? We have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. After the First World War, they isolated Germany.
And didn't work.
The result was Hitler.
Exactly.
The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan
And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had a conference on security and cooperation, the Helsinki Accords of 1975. And this was an interesting concept. Height of the Cold War, we had the arms race, of course, we had at the same time the German Ostpolitik and also the Détente politique by President Nixon. It was all a global context, of course. But it was the Helsinki conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival. Right. If you look at the security strategies right now, they're all full of this. And why? And it speaks about common security, cooperative security. And why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. Because security, if we make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security, and the other would feel it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palmer Commission later on.
Right, right.
Willy Brandt, Palmer, Kreisky, so they had this, this idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palmer, Willy Brandt, Gunnar Kreisky.
Yeah. I have to mention this. The one who really prevented the neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model, there were ideas, Western pundits, not just Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well. Mm-hmm. It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell. It was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US. They all said Rapacki Plan, Polish foreign minister. They wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, a nuclear weapon-free,
right,
with the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it would be also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed to it was Konrad Adenauer, etc.
Right.
But I have to say that the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
genau.
There was a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there were social Democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know. The time is
so. No, that would be interesting one. We should do it.
But I said, Europe, let me summarize, you have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this conflict on sanitaire.
But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, you know, they would hang him up, you know.
That's definitely...
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, you know, and it's interesting to me because, you know, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, you know, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, you know, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. The idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. This is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes. But it might change if Europe will feel the effects of the war and if they will learn about the casualties. So they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and... over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this
dichotomy.
So there's no place for complex analysis.
So we have to start.
Right. But let's just mention one thing that was an... poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which was taken before the war already. But the question was, if there is a conflict between US and China, it didn't even ask military conflict, it only said conflict.
Right.
What options would you choose? Go with China, go with the US, or stay neutral? So 60 to 65 of the Europeans would say the rather would be stay neutral. Of course, they would not want to side with China, but they would not want to be drawn into a military conflict on the side of a conflict with the US, which is not their own.
Professor, I think we have come to a good conclusion, which is the Austrian model is the best model for all of Europe.
I would agree.
That would be the best model. So, Professor, we have about 5 minutes left. If you could please, then let's look into the future. We already began talking about in terms of conceptually what could happen, but let's make it a little bit more practical. So you're saying right now the situation is very polarized. It's very hard to begin these conversations in Europe, even though the majority of the people in Europe feel that this is not in their interest. Of course, we have also the winter coming up and this issue of gas and the issue of energy prices. We see in Italy there's already riots, people burning their energy bills in front of the city hall and threatening a boycott of paying their energy bills. We see in Germany a very strange thing happening, people going back to the idea of using coal for fuel and going to the forest and cutting down the trees for the firewood. I'm simply saying these things because these are things that are actually happening. I don't want to, you know, exaggerate the issue, but it seems to me that this winter is going to be a very interesting winter in Europe because, as you said, the effects are going to be felt maybe in ways that still are not being felt, even though they are being felt. So if you could maybe give us some insight, give us your analysis and your views about this idea of having an alternative vision, a vision that's different than this Cold War and this idea of not having relations with Russia. If you could give us a little bit more practical, what you would suggest practically we should be doing maybe in the next 5, 6, 10 years for this to happen?
Yeah, I have to say, of course, it will be a difficult winter for Europe. It will be not that dramatic as some observers would see it, Of course, the reserves for gas and oil, 85%, they are full. But the problem is the price, because exactly. The Europeans are buying oil from gas from the U.S., from Norway, Netherlands, the democratic country of Azerbaijan, and
Algeria.
So and I don't want to be cynical now, but that's
yes, exactly.
It will be expensive, and the prices will be a problem. And we will have recovered after the pandemic. Now they will fall back in terms of unemployment. Some factories companies will close. So it will be very difficult. And the Europeans seem to be united in the sanctions against Russia. But if it comes to the energy discussion, of course, there are pledges that we are still united. Well, they're not that united, the Europeans. Mm-hmm. They have different interests, and you see it. Now, if you look at the debate on the price cap on Russian gas, so Austria, for example, and others would say, no, that's not feasible. Other European countries right. would want to do it. So in practical reasons, there might be come out very different things, and the European Union might blame members and other members which mm-hmm. are not going along. It might be Hungary and Poland. Maybe it will change in Italy with a new right-wing government as well. Some member states will blame the Commission, and there will be always the excuse, we have to do it on a European level. So we have to have a speak with one voice. That's not going to happen all the time. So because in foreign policy, of course...
Right. So, Professor, that's very interesting you mentioned this, because this brings me to maybe the gist of the whole... This the key to understanding a lot of things. We had this European integration process, and I remember you once mentioned the idea of these expectations not really meeting the reality. And in some ways, we maybe have... because we like to talk theoretically, both of us, in terms of our academic background, that maybe we have now come to the understanding that there is such a thing as national interests beyond what this idea of European common interest, that maybe there is going to be some sort of a, maybe not formally but informally, a split within the European Union.
We are back to another international relations theory. We have this functionalism, that's integration theory.
Exactly.
And the European idea was based on this. So that means you have cooperation on the lower level, science, technology, economy, spill over to political and security, and then common defense and common government. It worked to a certain level.
Exactly.
So it worked. But it does not go all the way. Common defense is no question right now. Common defense policy, yes. Cooperation, right. Strategic compass, everything. But it doesn't go to... Europe doesn't want a common commander, so who decides whether the soldiers are going to die.
Exactly.
So and not the common guy. And here the Europeans have to be realistic and say we have to can go to a certain level. And there can be multilateralism on this level, and the European Union can be active. And my favorite example is the GCPOA.
Right.
The GCPOA was after 2015 a masterpiece of multilateralism. But the idea is you have certain member states that can do something, and the European Union would support it. So you need not have the common consensus of all the states.
Right.
Otherwise, it's always an excuse. Right. So you can do this on a lower level, and some countries can do it. So the GCPA would be a good example. We will see how it plays out.
Right.
But for the European Union, it's possible that the European Union can do something on a level beneath the common government, beneath the common voice.
I guess my question is this, Professor. Is it really, are these those Western European nations and elites who are pretty much fully invested in NATO and in the alliance with America, are they capable of accepting that a country like Hungary, like Poland, like Germany, might have its own national interest vis-a-vis Russia as opposed to theirs? Maybe you could say, okay, Belgium, what does Belgium have to do with Russia? Okay, we can say that. But there are countries that really their national interest is not to be at war with Russia. I mean, is this something that, because this goes back to the idea of ideology, is the ideology so deep this Atlanticism, this idea of that, you know, America is the way to go for Europe, particularly after World War II and the horrors of Nazism, the crimes that happened with communism and Stalinism that happened in Eastern Europe. Is Europe capable of having this diversity of interests and handling it?
Of course, the transatlantic bonds are very strong. Of course, you have NATO, but Europeans always think the Americans helped out in the First World War, Second World War, were the leading state during the Cold War against the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union. They closed their eyes during the Vietnam War. They closed their eyes already when we had the coup against Mossadegh. They closed their eyes.
They usually close their eyes when the Americans...
In Chile.
Exactly.
But there have been differences already during the Iraq War. You saw Germany and France. They were not really happy with the decision, and there was no UN Security Council authorization. So we should not discard the transatlantic bonds.
Right.
But what I do think, of course, European states might find out they have their own interests as well, especially when it comes to the use of force, use of violence. After all, the European Union considered itself as a peace union from the start.
The whole point was that there would be no war.
Right.
Exactly.
So I should go back. It will be a process, but it might be possible.
Professor Gärtner, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you so much for our wonderful discussion that we had. I think we might have to do another one at some point, maybe the next season.
I'll come back to Tehran soon.
And next time you're in Tehran, inshallah, we can have another discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the conversation.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Gärtner? The US and NATO have once again successfully divided Europe and created a new Cold War against Russia by disregarding legitimate Russian strategic interests for decades and using any opportunity to provoke and humiliate Russia. Behavior which was criticized after the Cold War by none other than the father of Soviet containment policy, the late George Kennan, and which today is being criticized by none other than the still living Henry Kissinger. After NATO's humiliating defeat in its 20-year campaign in Afghanistan, this new Cold War and NATO expansion is a lifeline for the military-industrial complex in the United States, which requires permanent global war to justify its evil existence on this earth. Brainwashed Atlanticist European elites proudly reject the wishes of their own populations to proclaim their fidelity to NATO and their allegiance to the US, disregarding the real on-the-ground consequences of these policies for the daily lives of their own citizens. An unprecedented level of Russia-phobia and blatant in-your-face propaganda is sweeping the West, creating a suffocating atmosphere that gaslights and browbeats anybody who might dare to suggest that it is in Europe's real interest to have good relations with its massive neighbor, the Russian Federation, independent of what the US thinks of this. Once again, we come to understand that geopolitically, Europe is an American colony, physically and mentally occupied by one of the victors of World War II nearly 80 years ago. The Western rejection and isolation of Russia has been very good for Eurasian integration, the old nightmare of the British imperialists and their US inheritors, such as the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, creating a history-changing strategic alliance between the great Asian powers of Russia, China, and Iran in the global heartland. Of course, the old Anglo-American strategy is to separate Europe from Asia, to keep its European colony firmly in its own grip, and to divert Europe's wealth and resources towards its own military-industrial complex, depriving Europeans of the benefits of joining a new era in human history, the era of a strong and wealthy Eurasia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Bilmiyorum. Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Hafiz, the outstanding Persian poet, states, "Unattainable is the place of ease without toil. Yes, with the decree of calamity, they establish fate and destiny on the day of Alast." There is a difference between the words living and being alive. Some animals, like worms, try to be alive in moths. However, creatures like humans try to live, and this is a high status given to people. Of course, according to Hafiz, living in this world is not without toil, and we must be the producer of good deeds. We must be away from sins if we want to enjoy our life both in this world and the hereafter. This part of the Hafiz's poem referred to Ayah 172 of Surah Al-A'raf, which states, "When your Lord took from the children of Adam, from their loins, their descendants, and made them bear witness over themselves, He said to them, 'Am I not your Lord?'" This means that only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is able to develop humans in this world. And we all, on the day of Alast, confess that only Allah is our Lord. Thus, we must bear the toils in this world if we want to reach salvation. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.